Three Colonial Mothers. In the spring of 1676, James Chute, with his wife and two small children, set out from Dorchester for the purpose of settling themselves on a tract of land in the southern part of what is now New Hampshire, but which was then an unbroken forest. The tract where they proposed making their home was a meadow on a small affluent of the Connecticut. Taking their household goods and farming tools in an ox cart driven by four oxen and driving two cows before them, they reached their destination after a toilsome journey of 10 days. The summer was spent in building their cabin and outhouses, planting and tending the crop of Indian corn, which was to be their winter's food, and in cutting the coarse meadow grass for hay. Late in October, they found themselves destitute of many articles, which, even in those days of primitive housewifery and husbandry, were considered of prime necessity. Accordingly, the husband started on foot for a small trading post on the Connecticut River, about 10 miles distant, at which point he expected to find some trading shallop or skiff to take him to Springfield, 38 miles further south. The weather was fine, and at nightfall, Chute had reached the river, and before sunrise the next morning was floating down the stream on an Indian trader's skiff. Within 2 days he made his purchases, and hiring a skiff, rowed slowly up the river against the sluggish current on his return. In 12 hours he reached the trading post. It was now late in the evening. The sky had been lowering all day, and by dusk it began to snow. Disregarding the admonitions of the traders, he left his goods under their care and struck out boldly through the forest over the trail by which he came, trusting to be able to find his way as the moon had risen and the clouds seemed to be breaking. The trail lay along the stream on which his farm was situated, and 4 hours at an easy gait would, he thought, bring him home. The snow when he started from the river was already nearly a foot deep, and before he had proceeded a mile on his way, the storm redoubled in violence, and the snow fell faster and faster. At midnight he had only made 5 miles, and the snow was 2 feet deep. After trying in vain to kindle a fire by the aid of flint and steel, he prayed fervently to God, and resuming his journey, struggled slowly on through the storm. It had been agreed between his wife and himself that on the evening of this day on which he told her he should return, he would kindle a fire on a knoll about 2 miles from his cabin as a beacon to assure his wife of his safety and announce his approach. Suddenly he saw a glare in the sky. During his absence, his wife had tended the cattle, milked the cows, cut the firewood, and fed the children. When night came, she barricaded the door and, saying a prayer, folded her little ones in her arms and lay down to rest. Three suns had risen and set since she saw her husband, with gun on his shoulder, disappear through the clearing into the dense undergrowth which fringed the bank of the stream, and when the appointed evening came, she seated herself at the narrow window, or, more properly, opening in the logs of which the cabin was built, and watched for the beacon which her husband was to kindle. She looked through the falling snow, but could see no light. Little drifts sifted through the chinks in the roof upon the bed where her children lay asleep. The night grew darker, and now and then the howling of the wolves could be heard from the woods to the north. 7 o'clock struck, 8, 9 by the old Dutch clock which ticked in the corner. Then her woman's instinct told her that her husband must have started and been overtaken by the storm. If she could reach the knoll and kindle the fire, it would light him on his way. She quickly collected a small bundle of dry wood in her apron, and taking flint, steel, and tinder, started for the knoll. In an hour, after a toilsome march, floundering through the snow, she reached the spot. A large pile of dry wood had already been collected by her husband and was ready for lighting, and in a few moments the heroic woman was warming her shivering limbs before a fire which blazed far up through the crackling branches and lighted the forest around it. For more than 2 hours the devoted woman watched beside the fire, straining her eyes into the gloom and catching every sound. Wading through the snow, she brought branches and logs to replenish the flames. At last her patience was rewarded, She heard a cry, to which she responded. It was the voice of her husband, which she heard, shouting. In a few moments he came up staggering through the drifts and fell exhausted before the fire. The snow soon ceased to fall, and after resting till morning, the rescued pioneer and his brave wife returned in safety to their cabin. Story 2. In the early days of the settlement of Royalton, Vermont, a sudden attack was made upon it by the Indians. Mrs. Hendy, the wife of one of the settlers, was working alone in the field, her husband being absent on military duty, when the Indians entered her house and, capturing her children, carried them across the White River, at that place 100 yards wide and quite deep for fording, and placed them under keepers who had some other persons, 30 or 40 in number, in charge. Returning from the field, Mrs. Hendy discovered the fate of her children. Her first outburst of grief was heartrending to behold, but this was only transient. She ceased her lamentations, and like the lioness who has been robbed of her litter, she bounded on the trail of her plunderers. Resolutely dashing into the river, she stemmed the current, planting her feet firmly on the bottom, and pushed across. With pulled face, flashing eyes, and lips compressed, maternal love dominating every fear, she strode into the Indian camp, regardless of the tomahawks menacingly flourished round her head, boldly demanded the release of her little ones, and persevered in her alternate upbraidings and supplications till her request was granted. She then carried her children back through the river and landed them in safety on the other bank. Not content with what she had done, like a patriot as she was, she immediately returned, begged for the release of the children of others, again was rewarded with success, and brought 2 or 3 more away, again returned, and again succeeded, till she had rescued the whole 15 of her neighbor's children, who had been thus snatched away from their distracted parents. On her last visit to the camp of the enemy, the Indians were so struck with her conduct that one of them declared that so brave a squaw deserved to be carried across the river, and offered to take her on his back and carry her over. She, in the same spirit, accepted the offer, mounted the back of the gallant savage, was carried to the opposite bank, where she collected her rescued troop of children, and hastened away to restore them to their overjoyed parents. Story 3. Nearly 2 centuries ago, in one of those heated religious controversies which occurred in a river settlement in Massachusetts, a young man and his wife felt themselves constrained, partly through a desire for greater liberty of thought and action, and partly from natural energy of disposition, to push away from the fertile valley and establish their home on one of those bleak hillsides which form the spurs of the Green Mountain Range. Here they set up their household deities, and lit the fire of the fireside in the darkness of the forest and amid the wild loneliness of nature's hitherto untended domain. In such situations as these, not merely from their isolation, but from the sterility of the soil and the inhospitable air of the region, the struggle for existence is often a severe one. Perseverance and self-denial, however, triumphed over all difficulties. Year after year, the trees bowed themselves before the axe, and the soil surrendered its reluctant treasures in the furrow of the plowshare. Plenty smiled around the cabin. The light glowed on the hearth, and the benighted traveler hailed its welcome rays as he fared toward the hospitable door. Apart from the self-interest and happiness of its inmates, it was no small benefit to others that such a home was made in that rugged country. Such homes are the outposts of the army of pioneers. Here they can pause and rest, gathering courage and confidence when they regard them as establishments in the same wilderness where they are seeking to plant themselves. 5 years after their arrival, their house and barns were destroyed by fire. Their cattle, farming utensils, and household furniture were all fortunately saved, and before long, the buildings were replaced. And in 2 years, all the ravages of the devouring element had been repaired. Again, a happy and plenteous abode rewarded the labors of the pair. 3 years rolled away in the faithful discharge of every duty incumbent upon them, each toiling in their respective sphere to increase their store and rear their large family of children. A series of severe rains had kept them within doors for nearly 10 days. One afternoon, as they were sitting before their fire, they experienced a peculiar sensation as though the ground on which the house stood was moving. Running outdoors, they saw that the rains had loosened the hillside soil from the rock on which it lay, and that it was slowly moving into the ravine below. Hastily collecting their children, they had barely time to escape to a rock a short distance from their house when the landslide carried the house and barns, with the grounds on which they stood, into the ravine, burying them and their entire contents beneath 20 feet of earth. Almost worn out with his unremitting toils continued through 10 years, and seeing the fruits of that toil swept away in an instant, looking around him in vain for any shelter, and far away from any helping hand, it was not surprising that the man should have given way to despair. He wept, groaned, and tore his hair, declaring that he would struggle no longer with fates which proved so adverse. "Go," said he, "Mary, to the nearest house with the children. I will die here." His wife was one of those fragile figures which it seemed that a breath could blow away. Hers, however, was an organization which belied its apparent weakness. A brave and loving spirit animated that frail tenement. Long she strove to soothe her husband's grief, but without avail. Gathering a thick bed of leaves and sheltering her children as well as she could from the chilly air, she returned ever and anon to the spot where her husband sat in the stupor of despair, and uttered words of comfort and timely suggestions of possible means of relief. "We began with nothing, John, and we can begin with nothing again. You are strong, and so am I. Bethink yourself of those who pass by on their way to the great river every year at this time. These folks are good and neighborly, and will lend us willing hands to dig out of the earth the great that we have lost by the landslip." Thus through the night, with these and like expressions, she comforted and encouraged the heartbroken man, and having at length kindled hope, succeeded in rousing him to exertion. For 2 days the whole family suffered greatly while awaiting help, but that hope which the words of the wife had awakened did not again depart. A party of passing emigrants, ascertaining the condition of the family, all turned to, and having the necessary tools, soon dug down to the house and barn, and succeeded in recovering most of the buried furniture, stores, and utensils. The unlucky couple succeeded finally in retrieving themselves, and years after, when the father was passing a prosperous old age in the valley of the Mohawk, to which section the family eventually moved, he was wont to tell how his wife had lifted him out of the depths of despair by those kind and thoughtful words, and put new life and hope into his heart during those dark days among the mountains of Massachusetts.